Alfie Wharton, do you get ROI from your content?
Of course. I wouldn't do it if I didn't, you know. Yeah. I think for every, pound that we spend, we probably get between 10 to 20 pound back on content. So, I mean, that it's the most high leverage thing that we probably do, really, in terms of spending money to make money. Makes more than ads. It makes more than employees, really. Makes more than sponsorships, like paying to put our brand somewhere. Yeah, it's kind of like the golden goose, really.
Alfie, you are 2 years into running Alpha, mm-hmm. or thereabouts. What does Alpha do? Tell me about it.
We hire software engineers for growing tech companies and teams across the UK. So that's everything from a front-end React developer building some, you know, modern dating app to some back-end C# coder that's building some infrastructure for a banking system. And we find the best engineers in the country, in the UK, and then connect them with growing teams, growing businesses across AI and Web3 and fintech and the future and beyond, really. So we're helping scale tech companies. And the reason I love it is because when you do recruitment properly, you can benefit people and organizations in really profound ways. Like the right job can transform a person's life, and then the right person can transform a company. So when you get that magic right and that connection, then it really can have a wonderful effect.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I said, just about to go past a 2-year birthday for Alpha.
Sure. Soon.
Very soon. Yeah. This is exciting. Yeah. How has the progress gone for that sort of close to 2 years?
Yeah.
Are you happy where you are at? And tell me about that sort of initial journey, because most don't make it past that first year. You've already ticked that box.
I mean, happy, yes. Never satisfied. Always want more, right? And always want to be doing better. We started with no money, completely bootstrapped, never raised a penny. I put all my own cash into it. We've been profitable from basically day one, and I've managed to build on that, and now starting to build a team, a small team in London. Got people in the Philippines and Bangladesh and Pakistan and freelancers in the Netherlands and other places. And we've really built out the business to be a recruiting business, a platform for hiring the best talent, but also with a really big content-led approach. And that's through our newsletter Coder, through our podcasts that we do, and for our events that we run. And for us, you know, it's not just about putting in the right keywords and trying to find somebody on a database. It's really about trying to engage with the community, build long-lasting relationships. So if you say, hey, Alfie, I need a machine learning engineer with Python experience for this specific, AI project, I can think back to 9 months ago when I met somebody at a networking event who would have been perfect for that position. Not just on paper technically, but personality, team fit, culture, because that's just as important at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned recruitment of your own team, which I always find an interesting topic because you're very established. You are recruiting for other businesses. You've done it for another employer. You previously worked for Hays. Now, obviously, you could do it on your own. Recruiting for your own team, is it any different to, say, for recruiting for a tech company? And how has that journey been, becoming an employer instead of a potential team runner or team manager at another business?
Sure. I mean, I started Hays as a trainee, didn't know what I was doing, worked my way up the corporate ranks. And then 5 years later, I was the UK and Ireland national lead for software engineering recruitment. Had a team of like 60 recruiters, all hiring different people. So my last couple of years in that position were very strategic. They were about vision, setting a strategy, leading people, getting people on the bus and kind of getting them working towards the objective and goal. So I was used to that process. But it's a little bit different when it's your money on the line, and if it all goes wrong, then you're kind of fucked, So it's it's a lot more pressure. But I think ultimately, to answer your question, like the hard technical skills of a job, whether that's writing code or whether that's being an accountant or being a lawyer or whatever, like that's the differentiator. That's the part that you need to kind of look for and assess technically, which I can do. Doing that for years now. But the actual fundamental principles of what makes a good employee, what makes a good person, they are universal. They're, they last across time, across geography, and that's passion, that's hard work, that's persistence, that's intelligence, that's, you know, the ability to learn and show up and go the extra mile. And if people have those skills, it doesn't matter what you're recruiting for. That's the main thing that you need to look for.
100%. So you've gone for the in-person team approach, which I think for recruitment makes sense. I think most recruitment businesses are in person. Obviously, you do have some remote employees as well. So hybrid.
Yeah.
How are you approaching sort of team culture for the in-person team, but also involving those that are potentially from around the world?
Yeah, it's really hard, right? I personally like working in an office. I like a high energy sales environment, and that my industry recruitment, you kind of need to do that. I mean, I there's not many recruitment businesses that are fully remote that are really, really killing it compared to the ones that kind of have that tribe and that group together working together. Look, but I also believe in flexibility and, you know, in freedom. I've got a one-year-old, and it's nice to work, you know, like one day a week from home and have that freedom a little bit and an ability to see them. I'm definitely not as productive when I'm working at home. But I do believe that for the right person, they can make it work. And especially when you've got freelancers and contract staff and people overseas, well, it's impossible to get them to come to London every day, right? So you need to think about it logically. But yeah, look, I mean, it really depends on the job. Like a software developer that's building, you know, some app like Uber or Shopify or whatever, they can probably work from home a lot of the time and do just as good as a job as going into an office. You know, if you're sitting there with headphones on coding away, do you really need to be in a, you know, in five meetings a day in the city? Like, probably not. It just depends on the job, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. I think what is interesting with what you said there is obviously the balance between remote work and going into the office. Now, especially in the city, in certain industries, I suppose recruitment is potentially one of these. You are seeing an influx of managers, CEOs, bosses saying, come back to the office.
Yeah.
And in many cases, it's, no, you need to come back three times a week, four times a week. Do you see it ever going back to the five times a week where employers say, COVID's behind us, it is now back to five times a week, and maybe seeing that come back into, let's say, the majority?
I mean, we worked in offices forever until COVID, right? I think the pendulum swings. It went fully remote. It will go back to the office, then it will go remote again. It's just like politics. It goes left, it goes right. You know, people like to try different things. They get bored of it and they switch back, and people have a very short-term memory. They forget what it was like before, right? I hope it doesn't go fully back to kind of what it was. I do like the fact that the flexibility is there as an option. Even back when I was at Hays, even though it's a huge corporate business, there was hybrid working and flexibility. I personally would go in 5 days a week just because I enjoyed that and that was what I wanted to do. But it was nice to have that as an option. And some people wouldn't have stayed within the business, within the team, if that, you know, wasn't there. I think it's really hard to take it away from people if they've got used to working 3 days a week, you know, from home or something. Suddenly they have to go into an office 5 days a week. That turnover, you know, it's going to significantly increase. That retention is going to significantly come down. So, you know, it's a balancing act. I don't know what's going to happen. No, nobody does.
Sure.
But I think those CEOs, those directors, those leaders, I think a lot of them are going to be making a mistake if they're trying to enforce it without, you know, if they're ripping off the Band-Aid rather than kind of doing the baby steps.
Absolutely. But I think the directors and the CEOs are actually those that have probably got the most used to having some remote time, because compared to, let's say, the average 25 to 30 year old who has just gone into their career and it's kind of all they've ever known is that potential remote or hybrid approach.
Yeah.
You have a director or a CEO that's done full time in the office for 25, 30 years. And then suddenly they've gone, oh, you actually can spend 1 or 2 or 3 days a week at home with your family, your wife, your husband, boyfriend, girlfriend, toddlers, whatever that may look like. I think it's going to be harder for them to lead from the front and say, actually, no, we are going back in five times a week. I'm going to get up at 6 a.m. to get into the office for 8 because I actually live outside of London or outside of a big city, and go back to that grind, especially when they potentially enjoy the benefits more than anyone. So yeah, it'll be an interesting space. I think majority of people that I speak to, definitely from, let's say, those that are relatively young in their career, they definitely are enjoying being in an office, and they enjoy being in that environment. Having flexibility, yes, everybody wants choice. And I think that's important, especially to give that from a director. But in generally, I feel that people do want to be around other people. And that, as humans, for most humans, that is exactly what they want from sort of a working environment. So it's going to be an interesting space to see what happens. But those stereotypes around workforce, there's not one much bigger than the developer, the software engineer who likes a dark room and is massively introverted and sits on a keyboard and there's green matrix on the screen. And I, of course, say this lighthearted. I know from my previous business that how software engineers work. Do you think they want to go back into the office, or they've sort of enjoying remote work? And I guess, are you seeing an increase in remote jobs from obviously Alpha?
Well, it's probably a decrease, really, because during COVID, everything was remote. And now, slowly over time, it's gone from, hey, we're 5 days a week remote, hey, we're 4 days a week remote, 3 days, etc. And I'd say at the moment, the majority of the companies that we're recruiting for and hiring for are probably 3 to 4 days a week in an office at the moment, the majority of them. There are some outliers to that. There are some exceptions. And there are some businesses that are still fully remote and are absolutely killing it. But I think most people have realized, similar to what you said, to get that culture, to get that energy, to get that excitement, it is really important to keep a bit more of a balance. If you can go fully remote and make it work, amazing. Yeah. I haven't quite figured that out personally. I kind of need to be there. And like, we're doing this in person, right? Why aren't we doing this on a Zoom call? Because it's better in person. It's the only reason. Like, if we could do this on a Zoom call and it would be just as good, then we wouldn't have to get to the city and you know, go for all that hassle. So that kind of sums it up, really. A good question that I ask, I've recently started doing a tiny bit of investing in very early stage tech companies. And a good question I've been asking is, look, if you can get your team, your early team into an office, if you can pick 2 days a week or 4 days a week, but you can't do three, because three is the easy way of like being neutral on the fence, right? Would you pick two or would you pick four? And I really want to have people say four, because it shows, if they say three, a lot of the time they really want to say two, but they're hiding behind three. So it's a good way of separating it, you know.
Absolutely. I would definitely pick four.
Yeah.
Personally, but I like the fifth day of choice.
Sure, sure.
Very interesting question and a good question. Let's talk sales. You talked just now about your companies that you work with. Mm. Sales is probably the most important factor of any founder's life, especially in the early days before they can potentially hire someone to do those sales for them. How are you getting sales for a recruitment business? Are you that recruiter that is spamming my inbox saying, do you need a software engineer?
Have I sent you any emails? I don't think so. No. I mean, like, without sales, you are dead as a business. Like, without sales, you do not exist. You know, so that is, I mean, you need a good product, you need a good service, but if you can't sell it, then there's no point, right? How are we doing it? We do it through content and community. So the old way, when I started in recruitment, it was, there's a phone, there's a Yellow Pages, you know, start calling, make 1,000 calls and you'll get, you know, 5 to 20 meetings, you know, and then of those meetings, you'll get 2 or 3 clients and deals. And that, it worked, but that slowly, actually pretty quickly, dying out in emergence of the new ways of working, similar to what your business does. So we host podcasts, we do meetup events, we do ED&I initiatives, and we do a lot of really community-driven things to build actual relationships and connections with people. And we don't do it in a very salesy, pitchy way. I make it very clear that I have a business and here's what I do, and you know, that's how we make money, that's how we fund all of this, you know, cool shit and all these amazing parties. But can I swear on this?
Well,
I'm gonna swear anyway, so you can bleep it out. So look, we do all of these cool things to add value, to build relationships, to gain trust, to gain influence, to gain respect. And then if people are looking to hire, whether that's now, whether that's in 3 months, 6 months, a year, whenever, or never, and they can refer us, they know that we are the experts in that space. They know that we can help them. That's what we do. And we've given value to them. We've you know, we've helped them stand out, whether that's their profile, whether that's... The thing about recruitment is it's so people-driven. So it's all about helping people grow, not just as a candidate getting a job, not just as a company looking to build out their team, but also, you know, just in terms of their profile, in terms of getting them more recognized and becoming more of a thought leader in their space. So like podcast community, recruitment, they all connect perfectly together. Like I picked like the perfect business for a podcast, apart from like beverage drinks, like like Prime or Cano Water. That's like the big one, right? That's what everyone goes for. It's consumable. Yeah. But yeah, like we get sales by community, we get sales by adding value, and then a small percentage of those people will come and do business with us. We never ask, they just do it because they want to.
Perfect segue. Let's talk about sales with content and community. There are not many forward-thinking CEOs and founders out there at the moment, especially those that are starting a business or sort of sub 5 years in, that don't believe that content is a very important factor in their business operations. But there is a huge hesitation around producing high quality content or just content at all because it takes time. You, unlike pretty much every entrepreneur out there that have started a business in the last 10 years, have gone, start content before anything else, which is very unusual, because content... You have a podcast, it has 140 plus episodes, you have a newsletter, a magazine, you do a lot of content on social media, especially LinkedIn, which is obviously where your perfect customer hangs out. The challenge that I would say with that was, you start on day one, you might not see any inbound day 30, day 60, yeah, day 90, 120 and onwards. How are you still here if that's your main sort of channels? And are you seeing... now, after doing it for a couple of years, that regular influx lead generation?
All of our business basically comes through the podcast and the community and then referrals and that sort of thing. I don't make cold calls really anymore. I mean, it's a much nicer way of running a business when you don't have to get told to fuck off 100 times a day. I mean, I've been there, I've done that. If people want to do that, that's cool. It's just not for me personally. I'd much rather just build like, you know, friendships and relationships, and those people, if they want to work with us, cool, amazing. If not, then never mind. But you're right, it's an uphill battle, and I think a lot of people now are starting to realize that, and that's why everybody and their mum's got a podcast now, and it's just like completely taken off. But you know, we've been doing ours for 3 years now, almost 4 years, so we got in pretty early, and you know, we get thousands of views every single day across, you know, YouTube, Spotify, Apple, TikTok, Instagram, LinkedIn. LinkedIn's where we get most of our business from, but the other platforms are great for just driving awareness and followers and leads to it as well. And you know, we've interviewed some amazing people, you know, whether that's CEOs and founders in London that are running, you know, amazing AI companies, whether that's people in the tech world, like Harry Stebbings, who has 20VC, the podcast, whether that's DHH, the creator of Ruby on Rails, which powered, you know, Shopify and Airbnb and helped build all these amazing businesses. You know, and other people as well, right? So we've interviewed some amazing people, and that's led to some amazing business. But none of that would have happened without the content, without the podcast. So I started my podcast, you know, years before I started my business, because I could see that it was clearly going to be the future of sales and the way to do it. So I started it as my own personal brand, my own separate thing. Like, even though I was working at another company, I call it the Alfie Wotton Podcast for a very clear reason. You can't own my name. That's me. Yeah, and it's just my personal page and my way of building out the brand, which works great, because if I ever sell my agency, I've still got my podcast, you know, I've still got my newsletter. These are separate entities. My agency sponsors those. They're powered by it, but they're very separate things, right?
Yeah, makes perfect sense. So let's talk about process. So you just mentioned five, I think, different channels: LinkedIn,
yeah, probably
TikTok,
more. Yeah,
Twitter or X,
yeah,
newsletters, YouTube. It's a lot of effort for one person who realistically just wants the first £1,000 in the bank account, £5,000. And I appreciate you had a process before that. Did it ever get to a point where you have launched that new business and then you've gone, I might need to sort of cold outreach, because you're an ambitious person, most entrepreneurs are, or the good ones are anyway. Growth is important, and it takes time with the content, as we said. How have you found that process around producing content?
Well, I was fairly fortunate in the respect that I had a restriction, like a restraint of trade from my previous agency. So when I stopped with Hayes, I had a 6-month window where I basically couldn't do business anyway, but I could go out and do podcasts and build relationships and tell people, hey, on this date, I'll be able to help you. So then I started to do that. And then when that date came, I had a waiting list of people that wanted to do business with me. So, and then I had savings, and I've got an amazing wife who, you know, kind of was happily paying the mortgage and all that stuff while we waited. I mean, we had you know, enough savings to do that, but you know, and it's good to have a bit of a nest egg to fall back on when you are starting a company, because for the first couple of months, you're probably not going to make any money. For the first year, I basically didn't take a salary, just the minimum that, you know, was good for tax reasons, basically, right? So, I think it's going to take time, and you need to understand that. Like, it can take months. Sometimes I'll interview somebody on a podcast and I'll never hear back from them again. I'll be like, did I do something wrong? Like, we've made this amazing episode. But then a year later, they'll send me a referral, or they'll come to me with 5 jobs and that sort of thing. So it does work. And there's a lot of people that like to say it doesn't work because they did one podcast and it flopped. Like, our first 50 episodes got basically 0 views.
Sure.
Like, do you know how hard it is to do 50 episodes, like an hour long each, and nobody watches them? Like, it's painful. But then, you know, we get thousands a day now across all the platforms. So even though it's a very niche audience, it's a niche community, it powers everything else that we do. And it doesn't take a lot of time when you get a system in place. I probably spend 2 days a month on all the content, and that's it. We have a day of filming, basically, where we'll batch record a couple of episodes back to back. That will be enough for a month of content. That goes to an editor we've got currently in Pakistan, who then chops it up with multicams and the clips. We've got a separate guy for shorts, because that's a very unique way of doing it.
Yep.
Separate person for titles and copywriting, separate person for thumbnails for YouTube and for the magazine, separate person in the Philippines for actually making the magazine and the content, and then that all gets scheduled through Buffer. So my involvement is I show up and I speak to people, and then I just watch and I click approve as stuff goes on online, and then that powers everything else. So, you know, if you're spending more than like 2 or 3 days a month doing it, you're probably doing it wrong, in my opinion. When I started, I was spending 50% of my time doing it. But when you start making a little bit of money, you can delegate and outsource a lot of that stuff very cheaply and very quickly, and that will allow you to scale and focus on more of like the revenue driving activities.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's probably the biggest challenge around content at the moment, which is people look at the scale of that. I think when we play this clip online, sure, and people hear you say those 5, 6, 7, 8 different potential people or contractors that they need to organize and manage, and all the different factors that go into a high quality podcast and sort of social media presence like yourself, and which is growing fast, well done, it's great, they'll be scared.
Mm.
The turning up and recording sounds great, but the rest of that process, and of course, you know, that's why you do outsource that and you've put those sort of systems in place. It's why people use my business, Shea Content, and other businesses out there as well, to put those systems in place and do it for you. Mm. And I think, yeah, you've got it right, which is you don't actually need to spend that much time per month producing and editing and putting it online once those processes are in place. How have you found the growth from a perspective of those first 50 episodes? Great episodes, rubbish engagement, views, vanity metrics, feeling very sorry for yourself that potentially they are not working. As people say, not working, loosely. I think a lot of people, again, would get pretty scared about saying, oh, well, you're not going to see anything for the first 50 episodes of a podcast, potentially. Mm. Some of it might be 5, right? But let's say 50 for you. How did you maintain that energy and motivation? And then at what point do you reckon it sort of went, oh, actually, we know that every episode we're going to release, either that guest or that audience member, the viewer of that content, is potentially going to reach out?
Yeah. I mean, the first 50 episodes, they weren't good. Like, it was me on a Zoom call recording with a bunch of technical issues, no editing. They sucked, the first 50 episodes. I cringe when I watch them back, right? And then the biggest thing that you can do, really, is just every time you film a new one, try and implement one little change that makes it better. So maybe you buy a better mic, maybe you get better lights, maybe you buy a better camera, maybe you work on a better title or description or SEO or the thumbnail or whatever. We've recently started doing like top tier, you know, Diary of a CEO type shit. So we've got a fancy 1 minute trailer on the intro, which it's like Netflix quality. Even when I watch it back, I'm like, oh fuck, this is amazing. Like, let me watch this episode. I mean, I never really watch my own stuff. I just watch it on like 2x speed because I'm just looking for any inconsistencies in like the editing that I need to, you know, check before I approve it. Luckily now we've got somebody that almost does that for me. So I only need to watch certain things like the shorts. But yeah, like if you're not getting any views, the reason is probably because you're not good enough. Like if no one's watching your stuff, it's probably because that stuff sucks. And it's really hard to hear, especially when it's a podcast and it's your voice and your face and your name. But if nobody's watching it, it's because you're not doing a very good job. So you need to think, you know, how do I make this better? Like your competition, right, is just content. So people have an option when they've got their phone. They can watch Joe Rogan. They can watch, you know, Lex Fridman. They can watch Diary of a CEO. Or they can watch your podcast, which was filmed on Microsoft Teams with no editing. Who are they going to watch? Like, that you're competing against those people. So if you're not making it, you know, equally, you know, almost as good, then, you know, you're just one of a million podcasts out there. I mean, there's some crazy stat that it's like, out of all the podcasts ever made, like 90% don't make it past like one or two episodes.
Yeah.
And then like of those, 99% don't make it past like 50 episodes or whatever. I don't know what the numbers are. I'm just, you know, speculating. But if you can do 50 episodes and just get 1% better every single time, you will look back on the early ones and it will be a complete transformation. And having great production, great studios, all of that stuff, it's really important. But the most important thing I find is just the conversation.
Yeah.
It's audio most of the time,
I think, right? That's it, right? I think
there's
a level right now that you're at, which is actually focusing in on the editing quality, production quality, because your content is good. The value you're doing in that conversation is at a high standard. The reality is you're only in a position now to focus on editing and production and post-production level quality that you're saying to get it to that point where they will scroll past some famous people and still choose to consume your content or your podcast is because the value and the content has been there from day one, or at least in the first sort of handful of episodes. So I would also sort of caveat that and go the complete opposite direction, which is actually if you have a high valued conversation or high valuable conversation for a potential audience, which is potentially small or niche, you can do it at a very low budget and just make some very easy choices. So, for example, using a podcast recording software from home with a panel light, which is £20 off Amazon or wherever, a Rode mic or a USB mic, and maybe just some plants or some aesthetics behind you. Yes, okay, it's not going to be as high quality as a lot of podcasts out there, but you're already probably better than 99% of people that just click record on a Zoom with a blurred background because that's what they're used to. That looks horrible. Please don't do that.
Yeah.
But I think, people shouldn't get too scared if they've been sitting on that podcast idea for a year or two in a niche industry. Just get started. And once you get the hang of producing high quality content, and remember, for me, the content is the conversation. Content, I think, gets a bit lost with the editing and the animations. That's great. And that is, of course, content. But actually, the conversation is the important element of a podcast or a video series, even if you're just speaking directly to the camera, if you're educating or entertaining, the two clear routes that most people take.
Yeah.
That's what's important. And you can do that relatively low cost. Get good at that. Get a bit of traction, and then you can start spending money, and you potentially will get ROI. So let's talk about ROI.
Mm.
How much time, money, you don't have to give exact figures if you don't want to, that you put in to Coda that you're representing today from a newsletter point of view, or your own podcast, which is under your name, business. I care about revenue in my back pocket.
Sure, yeah.
Alfie Wattam. Do you get ROI from your content?
Of course. I wouldn't do it if I didn't, you know. I think for every, pound that we spend, we probably get between £10 to £20 back on content. So I mean that it's the most high leverage thing that we probably do, really, in terms of spending money to make money. Makes more than ads. It makes more than employees, really. Makes more than sponsorships, like paying to put our brand somewhere. Yeah, it's kind of like the golden goose, really.
100%. And great answer. For you personally, do you think that the majority of your business when you do podcasts and content comes from the relationships with the guests that you've had? So let's say you've had just short of 150 guests or relationships that you've built over an hour of producing content with them, and maybe a bit of time before or after, or the actual audience that's viewing? Because that's a question I get asked a lot.
Yeah, it's a good question.
Which is, obviously you get an hour with someone.
Yeah.
If you're a good salesperson or if you are just a nice person, potentially that will generate business. Especially if you 150, 10% of those 15 people potentially, let's say that you generate business from, depending on your service offering, that could be a lot of money.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, we're producing content most of the time, not for that one relationship. We're producing it for the thousands of impressions or 10,000s of views that you might be getting, for example.
Sure. It's probably more the audience watching now. Yeah. Well, when I started, it was definitely the relationships because no one was really watching it. But when people start watching it, you know, if they refer you to somebody or somebody watches it and you keep showing up on their feed, like you wanted me on this because you said you keep seeing my face appear everywhere, right? And then that's where you get in touch and it's inbound. I never messaged you. You messaged me. I was like, yeah, sure, I'll do this. And it's the same with content. Like people will come to you. They will ask you for business if you are always consistently showing up. And you can get that from the guests. You can get that from appearing and building a relationship with people. But, you know, on a lot of our episodes, we'll have two or three guests. So I probably had over 300 people on the podcast. And that's probably led to maybe 30, maybe 20 to 30 people that have given us jobs, maybe like 1 in 10 or something. But from the people watching, it's a lot more than that, you know.
So this is super interesting, right? So I think people can get business from a podcast. And when I say get business, I mean return of investment. It's what we care about. If I'm going to spend time and energy and money into producing a podcast of any quality, I want to know relatively, and I suppose it is the how long is a piece of string or et cetera kind of sort of adage, but I want to know, when am I going to get my return from this investment into this channel?
Yeah.
So I think what you're saying is, especially for the first year, probably, of producing, let's say, an episode a week, which is quite a lot, much more than most people do. I think it was more from the relationships that you gained from recording it with, for example, you're my guest on this.
Yeah.
Versus now, once that traction has been built, it's from the audience members. And I guess they're just literally finding you on LinkedIn and said, hey, I saw your interview with X or Y, would be interested in using you as my recruitment provider or service, which, let's be honest, there's nothing unique relatively about your service offering at Alpha, right?
Yeah.
What's unique is the vehicle that you're sharing about it.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, basically. I mean, the simplest way that I look at it is it's all about compounding. Like, it's going to start like this, like really, really, really slowly. And then it doesn't go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It goes 1, 2, 4, 8, 16. And then by the time you get to 30, you're over like a million or a billion. It scales so quickly, right? Like you can get more views. We've had more views in the past 3 months than we got in the past 3 years, really. We did more business in Q1 of this. I mean, we're only in February, but January and February and March, because we have deals booked in going into next month, we've done more business than last year. And it's all come from the podcast. It's all come from the community and the events and the referrals that have come from the back of that. Could I have done that by cold calling? Maybe. But would it be enough fun? And can cold calling compound in the same way? No, because when you produce something and it's evergreen and it's out there, people are going to find it, share it 5 years from now, right? And it's always a great lead magnet. And if I've got, you know, 150 podcast episodes and each of those become 10 clips and each of those become 10 shorts, that's 1,000 lead magnets. Mm. And shorts become, you know, drive traffic to episodes. People watch episodes, they become followers, they keep hearing the ad over and over again. A small percentage of those become buyers, a small percentage of those become repeat customers. And then you've got a pretty cool business that we're talking about, right?
I think what a lot of potential content creators miss, and when I say content creators, anyone could be a content creator, so let's say business owner, I think what a lot of business owners miss is the value of one episode of an episode of a podcast they do and what that can look like. So of course you need to do more than one, you need to compound it over a period of time and that will gain traction. But let's just take one episode, right? One episode gets put up on YouTube, it's an hour long, it has a title which hopefully is enticing, it has a guest. It has then a description below it. You then chop this video up and put it onto other social medias, TikTok, Instagram, LinkedIn. You can even do it yourself. It might be a bit rusty, a bit rigid, but
sure.
The general principle is there. You can then utilize that content and use it for quite a long period of time. But whilst you're chopping that up and you're spending that time doing that, go back to YouTube and actually think about that for a second. If someone searches the name of your guest, you might appear. If someone search the title of your podcast episode, they might find you. Something that you've mentioned a couple of times from keywords in that YouTube description, they might find you. Compound that 150 times and you're effectively just putting yourself out there so much and in so many different ways and so many different ways that people kind of don't realize you're as impactful as paying tons of money to Google Ads or paid advertising and driving traffic to your landing page, because every single piece of content is your landing page can be used in that way. So I think there is just a level of education, especially in the UK, we're definitely a few years behind the US with regards to content creation. Things like demand generation, which is a very common term at the moment being utilized. People are hiring for demand generation jobs now here in the UK, but been going on for the US for a couple of years. How do you see your average B2B business that's potentially 10 years into their business operations, maybe marketing stagnated, maybe sales stagnated a touch, or they just want to grow to the next level, never produced a piece of content, should they start?
I mean, the biggest people will say, oh, it's a risk because I'm not going to be spending my time doing the things that previously made me money. But I would say the biggest risk is really just not doing anything at all, because some other company is going to do it. They're going to get the eyeballs of your market. They're going to become the authority figure in that space. And then you're going to be kind of screwed, really. So I think you have to start. I think something that Gary Vee says, which is really important, is that every business should become a media business first, and then what they actually do. So you're not a legal practice anymore. You're a media company which has a team of lawyers which can help. Right? You see this with investing companies like A16Z, one of the biggest like tech investing companies in the world. They are a media platform which invests in companies, and it's a great way of saying it. Mm-hmm. Right? TV killed radio.
That's a change, right? A change. A16Z have changed.
Yes.
Over the past year.
Sure.
To that adage.
Yeah.
Around being a media company, they hired really effectively. I think they took on a couple of younger creators and sort of stole them from places like The Hustle and a few other really big publications in the US, who eventually sold to HubSpot and things like that.
Yeah.
But they clearly saw a route that the market was going to take, and now they are saying that's their tagline, which is so rogue, because that's never what they've sort of stood for. And I think they've just seen where the market is going, and they've changed. It's not something which they've been in business and made all their money from being like that for the past 20 years. This is something which they are a massive business, making tons of money with huge reputation, and they've only changed and pivoted into something quite important, which is their tagline, their main, this is what we do and this is what we are, over the past period of like couple of years, which is very interesting.
Harry Stebbings said exactly the same thing to me. He told me that 20VC podcast is his shop window. And he makes it really niche, really specific. It's all about the VC community. It's all about raising money. And then the people that watch that show are not the same people watching Logan Paul videos, right? Nothing wrong with Logan Paul fans. You know, he's a cool guy, I imagine. But the people watching his show are founders and CEOs and investors. He's got a tiny audience compared to, I don't know, Mr. Beast or KSI or whatever, but he probably can make more money from you know, that audience in the long run, because it's a high net worth individual watching the show. And that's the thing about content. You want it to be really, really specific for your avatar, your ideal customer. You don't need a million views.
No.
I'd rather have 10,000 views of people that can buy my stuff rather than a million views of 12-year-olds.
100%. I mean, at the end of the day, you don't even scale it to 10,000. It could be 1,000. It could be the nichest podcast ever or the nichest piece of content. People get very obsessed with putting a post on LinkedIn, or let's say I give LinkedIn a go for 30 days or a month, right? A working month, and I'm getting just a few hundred impressions or 1,000 impressions. I'm getting 1-2s engagement, likes, comments, and I'm feeling very demotivated because I've gone for the vanity metrics. And actually taking a step back is that there are a lot of lurkers on your LinkedIn and other mediums. So a lot of people are consuming your content. You might just not see it. But what you will see is the impressions. And at the end of the day, if your content is saying X amount of views, Y amount of impressions, that is 1, 2, 3 thousand, 10,000, 100,000 eyeballs on your content. Now, unless you plan to go hire out a big stadium, do a magic show, which I know you've done before in your past, and do that live in front of the audience and spend a lot of money doing that and a lot of organization, it's the only other way you can get someone's attention for that period of time. And I appreciate that the average impression may not necessarily dwell on your content, but let's say 1 in 3 do. That's still a lot of people that are seeing your potential face, opinion, tone of voice, which then when you do eventually get on a sales call with them, you're in a position where you go, I don't need to explain to you who I am, what my opinion is, or my tone of voice is, because actually just by listening to one episode of, you know, Alfie and Nick Telson, I can go, I actually kind of understand your tone of voice and your opinions on a few items, which we can then delve into.
Yeah, the pitch is already done at that point.
Yeah.
And if you can get guests like, you know, Nick's a wonderful guy, for example, if you can have him on your podcast, he built and sold Design My Night for like 25, 30 million or something. Just by having him as a guest, people start associating you with that individual. Like, you know, he's light years ahead of where I am, I can comfortably say. But if your names are together on a title and you do that with 50 different people at their level, suddenly you by association, by proxy, have become one of those people in the online world, which can translate to money and real world things as well. So
yeah, absolutely. You're giving them a platform to promote themselves and reach their own goals, which, yes, okay, maybe at this point in time more lofty for you as a podcast host, for example, but at the end of the day, they're also, you get to leverage them. You get to leverage them in any way you can, and that's not a manipulative way or sort of through the side door kind of way. It's just that is their mutual understanding that you're going to support one another in this vehicle, because it's nice to be invited to things. It is nice to be looked after in that way. And I think, yes, of course, some people are just very busy and they will turn you down, but it's a great way to meet people. And I found that myself from running podcasts and video podcasts. It's no different to going to an event and potentially bumping into someone. You get an hour of focus time to get to understand them a little bit more. You might learn something. You'll definitely learn something, but you might also get a friend. Who knows?
Probably the easiest way to get meetings with millionaires, right? If you try and pitch millionaires on a 15-minute coffee, hey, I'll buy the coffee for you or whatever, right? To try and sell them a product or a service, hey, it's probably not going to work very well. You need to send a lot of those emails to get responses. If you are inviting somebody to be a guest on your thing, your show, whatever it is, and you put effort and time into the production, into the editing, they're going to appreciate that. They're going to be very, very receptive and open to that, build a relationship with them, and then they are going to be a very you know, willing buyer potentially of whatever you have. And it can be anything. Like if you have an audience, you can sell them anything as long as it's within that niche in the future. That's why I started my podcast before I even had a business, before I had something to sell, just because I understood that the power of an audience, even no matter how small, as long as it's targeted.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I've got two questions for you about your podcast, actually, as someone who has recently discovered you from a podcast perspective. I've known about Alpha for a bit of time, as we used to share a very similar space. But for some reason, I've only just seen your sort of podcast, and you've got a plethora of amazing guests on there. You've had millionaires. You've had a billionaire, I believe, on there as well, which is incredible.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want you to upset anyone, but have you had a favorite guest in the last close to 150 episodes?
I mean, the Harry Stebbings one was the one where I learned the most, because that guy is basically my age, it's like a few months apart or something, and he's doing so well. So when I see people like that, it's such an inspiration, it's such a drive. I've had some like crazy, chaotic, controversial guests as well, which I might not always agree with everything that they say, but you know, certainly believe they've got a right to say it, and it's good to get different perspectives in the room. So we did an episode with a guy called Craig Wright, who claims to be Satoshi Nakamoto, the creator of Bitcoin. Okay. He's actually literally right now down the road in a massive, massive legal case. I think it's like the biggest financial case in history. He's up against Mark Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey from Twitter, and it's a group called Copa. They're claiming he's a fraud, he's a liar, he's claiming to be the inventor of Bitcoin. And in a few weeks, a judge will decide on what that happens. So just in the past couple of days, we've had like, I think it's like 6,000 views on that episode across all platforms because of that, even though it was filmed a year ago. It was filmed in that room, actually. You know, super controversial guy, but it's just good to get different perspectives and opinions, even if you don't necessarily agree with everybody all the time. That's the beauty of a podcast. You can stay somewhat neutral and, you know, and allow people to debate and get their opinions out. So it's so hard to pick a specific guest, but if you put a gun to my head, maybe, and say I had to pick one, it would probably be Harry Stebbings. That guy is such a nice, sincere, but inspiring person.
Super intelligent guy. For sure, there's no doubt about that. Another person, another individual that has gone content first.
Yeah.
He is one of the biggest believers of content. And I've never met Harry, but you can just clearly see that he went all in on content at a very early stage in his
18 years old he was when he started it. Now 3,000 episodes later or something, you know, he's built a company which is invested in Linktree and Be Real and, you know, loads of amazing tech companies, right? And that guy will be a billionaire one day, I imagine.
It's incredible. But what's so interesting about that is, I want to emphasize this, you don't need to be a YouTuber, an 18-year-old, a 25-year-old, even a 30 or 35 or 40-year-old who loves tech and loves content, is digesting X, Y, Z on YouTube, your Mr. Beast, your Logan Pauls, etc., to produce a high-quality podcast, piece of content, whatever that may look like. Maybe it's written, maybe it's video, etc. You could be 15, 20, 30 years into your journey as a B2B operator, CEO that's maybe returning millions a year for their company, but just understands, and this is important, but understands the importance of content to get started. You need your process, you need your strategy, but don't get too obsessed with these people that are of a really young age, 25, 30-year-olds who are making millions, in some cases billions, and they all do that through content. Don't let that distract you if you are listening to this and you're a 45-year-old, because, or a 50-year-old or a 60-year-old, whatever that may look like. Because if you invest your time and potentially you have the money now to put it into a good process, give it a year and you'll reap the benefits. And hopefully you enjoy it. Because I think a lot of entrepreneurs and founders, CEOs, directors, they enjoy speaking to people. They have a black book of amazing people that they've spoken to in the past and they potentially want to speak to in the near future, which gives a range of opinions and viewpoints. So it is just a case of, it is the biggest cliche out there, right? Which is get started.
Sure. And just, you know, if you don't have time for it, just document rather than create. I mean, like, you're already doing the meetings, just click record and then have someone chop it up and put it out there. I mean, it's not taking any extra time. You know, you don't need to sit down in front of a camera and start talking and filming stuff. You know, you're already doing that meeting. You're already, if you're a leader, you're already running a training session, you know, for your team. And then, you know, stick a few GoPros in there and you know, there we are. We've got that training session and you've made it evergreen. So if people in that were in that group want to go back and watch it, and new staff coming in, if they want to be part of that induction process, they want a library of material, then boom, that there it is. I mean, a lot of the best content that I've ever made was internal. It was stuff that I've made for my team. We put it out there, not really thinking anybody would find it valuable, but it's taken off for whatever reason. So, you know, I think a lot of it comes down to not just trying to play to the algorithm, not trying to, you know, create content that you would want to watch, because there are enough people out there that are similar to you that they'll probably enjoy it as well. But if you just try to Mr. Beastify everything, I mean, he's already, like Jimmy's already like the best at what he does. The world doesn't need another Mr. Beast. The world needs you. And your story, your vision, you know, your voice, and nobody else can do that. If you try and copy somebody else, you'll just be a second-rate version of that person. And there's probably things that I could do in the short term with our pod to, you know, really increase the audience. But in the long term, that would hurt us. And I'd much rather just slowly, consistently grow it over time in the right way, rather than go for those kind of peaks and troughs and get a bigger, you know, number of viewers, but not a higher quality number of viewers. Like recently we found out on X that Michael Dell watches my podcast sometimes. The creator of Dell Computers, that the 13th richest man in the world, has been liking our podcast clips. It's absolutely insane. Like, I'd much rather have that as a viewer than 100,000 people that would never, you know, buy my stuff or be interested in it. It's just a crazy thing to think about.
Yeah, that's awesome. Who gave Michael Dell X or Twitter? he's liking content from over the pond.
Yeah,
I mean, look, that's incredible. He's literally the perfect person to be engaging with your content, and that's it. You are very specialist in the tech space with all the content you produce, and this is where people like that, and even someone who is 1% the size and reputation and fame, I suppose, as Mr. Michael Dell, engaging with your content is still a perfect customer for you. And they will be engaging with it because they would rather engage with a piece of content that is more relevant to them, like a sports podcast content creation, which you're only half a bit sporty. Not that interesting to me, even if it's amazing content. Whilst I am a tech entrepreneur, I'm going to listen to the Alfie Wharton podcast.
Yeah.
I mean, you should anyway. That's what I've been told.
The riches are in the niches. That old cliche is like so true. Like, content made for everybody is content made for nobody.
100%. So Alfie, what's next for you? What is next for Alpha, for your content over the next year and next 5 years?
So right now, the primary focus is on scaling Alpha Technology Recruitment with a London-based team of recruiters, essentially. So we're hiring at the moment, looking for people that want to do all facets of market research, of networking, building relationships, interviewing candidates, managing the CV submission, the interview process, closing deals. So it's sales, it's marketing, you know, it's research, it's all of these areas together. My 90% of my time is trying to find, train, motivate, and keep alive a team of people that can do that. And then, you know, it's like I said, with compounding. So with the content and the podcast guest says it's going to get bigger and better, and the editing, the production, that's going to get bigger and better over time. That all links back to Coda, our newsletter. So that, you know, we want to get more people reading the Substack and more people engaged on that side of the coin as well. That will lead to bigger events. So everything that I'm doing at the moment, I don't want to do anything extra. There's no new. I'm not going to start a vlog or anytime soon, right? I want to you know, keep the pillars in place and just grow them all, consistently over over time, you know, to the point where we can hopefully exit the recruiting business in a couple of years, and then, you know, build up a bit of a war chest to do the next thing, right? So yeah, I mean, like, all of that is kind of housed just on alfiewottam.com, my personal website. Rather than giving away like 50 links, that's the one to go to, and then that's just got links there for everything else. You know, whether that's I'm trying to do a little bit of speaking and other people's podcasts and that sort of thing as well. But 90% of what I'm doing is trying to help tech companies, trying to help AI startups, trying to help, you know, Web3 unicorns, and guide them, scale them, and kind of take them to that next level, really, through the best engineers in the UK.
Amazing. Alfie Wottam, you have been my everyday founder. Thank you very much.
Cool. Thank you, mate. Awesome.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Everyday Founder. If you haven't already, like or subscribe wherever you are watching or listening to this episode. If you know of an incredible founder that story needs to be shared, then let me know who you would like to see next on The Everyday Founder by the comment section or messaging me on LinkedIn. These episodes are brought to you by Shake Content, your LinkedIn content agency. So please show them support on all socials so that we can keep bringing you amazing guests and sharing their stories on The Everyday Founder.